Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Britain, in the name of development aid, spawned corruption and injustice in Afghanistan for 20 years following the invasion. And we shall also look at growing tensions between regional rivals India and China, fueled by the construction of dams on the Brahmaputra River.
A British government watchdog report says much of the £3.5 billion aid London provided to Afghanistan following the invasion of the country in 2001 was not spent on humanitarian aid, as claimed by the government officials, but on military operations, which in turn spawned rampant corruption and injustice. This mammoth funding served to advance the broader geostrategic and military agenda of the neo-imperial powers in the conflict-ridden South Asian country instead of humanitarian aid, relief or construction, with almost all international bodies aiding in the endeavor.
The Independent Commission for Aid Impact, a government body tasked with scrutiny of British development aid, in a report published last month, denounced the use of aid budget to fund the salaries of Afghan police and military as a questionable use of UK aid. The British government splurged £252 million on the salaries of Afghan National Police and £400 million on Afghan security services over the last 6 years of its operations in the country. Despite efforts by aid officials to stop the funding, the government overruled the move as it sought to prioritize the transatlantic alliance in line with its coalition ally, the United States. The report cited the British government documents that describe the situation as an extreme form of state capture, which benefited a narrow group of Afghan political elites at the expense of the population at large. The report added that in these circumstances, there was little prospect of meaningful institutional development in the war-ravaged country. The largest UK contribution of £668 million was to the World Bank program designed to fund basic services such as health and education, infrastructure investment, agriculture and jobs, but none of it managed to make any material difference to the lives of Afghan people.
Well, sure, they left it as in a greater mess than they had when they got there. So that of course is the responsibility of the force that had been there for 20 years. Somehow I cannot just leave and say, well, you're on your own now. But there has been little indication the United States is prepared to do that. They thought that they could set up a satrap state under their direct control. That didn't quite work. So instead, now that it does have a government, which seems to be relatively in control, not entirely, but relatively in control, they would have the opportunity to try and assist to repair some of the damage that had been done by the 20-year devastation that was the occupation of Afghanistan by U.S. and British and NATO forces, in effect.
The hasty and ignominious drawdown of American and British troops from Afghanistan last August, after two decades of military occupation and horrendous war crimes, left the South Asian country on the brink of a monumental humanitarian catastrophe. For 20 years, foreign invaders exploited the country in the name of development and democracy. 20 years down the line, the country's economy is devastated, terrorism and insecurity are at their peak, and earthquakes and natural disasters have increased. All these problems have been compounded by the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. government.
Foreign powers invaded Afghanistan in 2001, ravaged its natural resources, destroyed the country, and abandoned it in complete ruins. According to the World Bank, the landlocked South Asian country is the sixth poorest in the world, with a gross national income per capita of only $500. The UN estimates that 24 million Afghans, or more than half of the population, today suffer from acute hunger. An estimated 8.7 million are at risk of famine, and 5 million children are on the brink of starvation. The situation has been complicated by the freezing of Afghan national assets by the U.S. government, the suspension of foreign aid, and a crippling economic blockade.
Well, obviously, the Afghan war was very controversial for American citizens. I mean, the number of deaths, American deaths there, the amount of treasure that was spent in the military operations in Afghanistan, essentially, you know, robbed a lot of people of not only their livelihoods, but also the lives of loved ones. This is the reason why the U.S. Really was forced to pull out. Because of this, the popular opposition to continued operations in Afghanistan, but they did it in such a way that they wanted to try and go and then put it behind them and pretend it didn't happen. Now, obviously, people are aware of the tremendous cost in terms of those who lost their loved ones. I mean, this can all easily be counted. But the overall costs of that war are still probably much greater than has been indicated. And therefore, if the truth really comes out, the reaction against those forces who were responsible for it would be so great that it could really overturn the apple cart in the political situation here in the United States.
The invasion of Afghanistan, which was led by the U.S. and the U.K., was in the first place based on a false premise. 20 years of war destroyed the country and produced one of the largest refugee populations in the world, despite tall claims of development by the foreign powers. After the hasty withdrawal last year, the British government vowed to give asylum to thousands of Afghans who worked with British forces. But more than a year later, they remain trapped in Afghanistan or neighboring Pakistan, which only underscores the devastating impact of 20-year military occupation in the name of building democracy and humanitarianism.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the managing director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Now, according to the British government watchdog, much of the aid the UK provided to Afghanistan between the year 2000 and 2020 served to entrench corruption and injustice in the country. Now, does that surprise you in any way?
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show. Actually, such revelation by the British watchdog does not surprise me because it is a well-known fact that much of the foreign aids and foreign money came into Afghanistan went to the corruption. That was the basic reason that despite all these efforts of 22 years, they could not build a nation, they could not build a state. All the state functionaries collapsed as soon as the Western forces withdrew from Afghanistan. So it was a well-known fact. And actually, there is another fact that the Americans and their allies, particularly the Americans, they actually supported this corruption by their decision-making. And certain individuals were arrested in the Gulf, one of the Gulf states, one of the brother of one of very influential personality in Afghanistan were arrested. Briefly, then American intervened and he was released. So the corruption was not something which was not known to the Western powers. It was well known to them and it was well known to everybody. And you see all these people who were in power during this foreign occupation. Where are they? They all have gone out of the country because there is no more money in the country to earn. So unfortunately, they came here for some other reasons, which I may let you know in my another reply. But there was the corruption was not a problem at all for the Western powers.
Now, Mr. Khan, instead of spending on humanitarian issues, the report says that billions of dollars worth of foreign aid was designed for broader geostrategic and military agendas in Afghanistan. Now, does that explain the basic aim of invading and occupying the country?
You know, from the fact that when 9/11 happened, after that, everybody knew that the then government of Taliban, although the world may have a lot of problems with them, but none of the Taliban leader was involved in planning or executing, or even they didn't know about the 9/11. There was a strategic game which was planned and played in Afghanistan, on the soil of Afghanistan. Nation building or anything else was never an objective by the Western powers, unfortunately. And all that money came here was for some strategic designs. And eventually they failed because it is not possible for you to come invest in a country and try to change its values. The West came here and they tried to impose their version of democracy here, try to tell the people how to behave, how to, you know, do your daily lives, how to alter your values, which failed. Their prime objective was to use Afghanistan as a strategic chip against other countries in the region like China, Iran, Russia. And for 20 years, they invested. And because their intention was not clear, their intention was nefarious. And that is perhaps the reason that they failed. They never came here for some positive design. So for these Western rich countries, such amount of money is perhaps nothing to lose if their strategic designs are served.
Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
London-based political activist Mervyn Hardwick says much of the UK's £3.5 billion aid to Afghanistan between 2000 and 2020 was spent as a cover for military domination. Patrick Wintour, Guardian diplomatic editor, cited an official review to note that the British aid to Afghanistan, largely directed by the US, only entrenched corruption and injustice. British barrister Jane Heybrook remarks that the speed with which the US and UK abandoned Afghanistan last year was to prepare for the next theater of war in Ukraine.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Amid China's plan to construct a super hydropower dam on the Brahmaputra, a transboundary river that flows through South Asia and represents a source of life for more than 130 million people in China, India and Bangladesh, Sino-India tensions have taken a new form and dimension. The Brahmaputra is deemed one of the basins most at risk for interstate water conflict. Although an all-out water war seems less probable, the strategic river continues to be intricately connected to tensions between India and China, complicating their long-lasting territorial dispute.
More than 2 years after China announced plans to build the 60-gigawatt super hydropower dam in Taiwan on the Brahmaputra River, close to the boundary with India, India is also mulling over constructing a 10-gigawatt dam to offset the impact of water flows from China's dam. The Chinese project, which was included in the country's five-year plan for 2021 to 2025, is poised to be the world's biggest dam that will come up in the foothills of the Himalayas. The Brahmaputra, which originates in the Qinghai Tibet Plateau in southwest China, flows 2,900 kilometers across southern Tibet via the Himalayas before entering India. Each country in the region seeks to maximize its utilization, including India and China. The relations between China and India over shared water resources remain deeply complicated, with the Brahmaputra being essential to their socio-economic development. It accounts for nearly 30% of India's fresh water resources and 40% of its total hydropower potential. For China, the river's role in the fresh water supply is limited, but it plays a key role in Tibet's agricultural and energy industries. Despite China's insistence that the dam activity is meant for hydropower generation, India remains deeply skeptical, adding to tensions between the two countries.
The long-lasting territorial disputes between India and China only complicates matters, with both Asian giants asserting competing claims on the territory in the Eastern Himalayas administered by India. That has caused a deep trust deficit between the two sides on all matters, including shared water resources, and both countries today accuse each other of hydro-hegemonic behavior in the region, with the Brahmaputra being a flashpoint. Due to their geographical location, upstream countries are in a position to manipulate the water flows for their strategic gains.
As the upstream superpower of the region, China does not have any transboundary river policy, but manages the issues bilaterally with downstream countries. It also has not signed a water-sharing treaty with any country. Domestic challenges, including the need for energy security and the global infrastructure development project called the Belt and Road Initiative, mainly drive the country's water diplomacy. Interestingly, many of China's downstream neighbors, including India, have also not signed any such agreement. India has long feared that China intends to use the hydropower dams to assert its control over the Brahmaputra, with many speculating that it will potentially lead to water wars between the two Asian powers. India has repeatedly blamed China for stemming the flow of the Brahmaputra, damaging the ecology and disrupting agricultural production in the country. China has dismissed the criticism. The construction of super hydropower dams on the river is now adding a new dimension to the narrative of water wars between the two sides. Indian media has been aggressively pushing the narrative, while Chinese media has rejected it as an absurd theory. Although it is still under construction, its size and the potential impact on river flows have heightened India's fear of water shortage, aggravating geopolitical tensions.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Andrew K.P. Leung from Hong Kong. He's an international and independent China strategist. Now, the already fragile relationship between regional rivals India and China is set to become tenser amid Beijing's plan to build a super hydropower dam on the Brahmaputra River near India and India's counter plan. So how do you see this fresh duel playing out?
The Himalaya represents one of the world's most dynamic and systems because it supplies water to China, India, and also Bangladesh. And then apart from the Brahmaputra, there is the Ganges River, there's the Indus River, and a number of other major rivers flow through from the Himalayas, fresh water systems. Now, this water systems supplied population downstream, numbering some 1.9 billion people in so many different countries. And then these countries rely on this water, not just for drinking, but also for fisheries, for irrigation. So it's hugely important for their economies and the livelihood of the people. Now, of course, China is in the upstream position in the Himalayas. And China, like some other Asian countries, are very water deficit countries, particularly China. China has got the one-fifth of the world's population, But the average water availability in China, the fresh water availability, is only a third of the world average. The world average, of course, includes the most arid regions in the world, including sub-Saharan Africa. And there is not much water up north in China, too much water down south, resulting in major floods. And other countries also rely on water, as I said, not just for drinking, but for agriculture, but also for the cotton, the filling cotton, filling the industries.
Mr. Leung, as one of the world's most impoverished regions, each country in South Asia wants to maximize the utilization of the Brahmaputra River, which is known as Yarlung Sango in China. Why is this river so important for India and China in achieving development goals?
Well, it's important for China because China, as I said, is a water-poor country and relying on fresh water from the Himalayas, not only for the western regions in China bordering the Himalayas, but then the water also flows from the western part of China to other parts of China to the east. So it's a very important water system to China. Likewise, the water flows down India, Bangladesh, at least the Brahmaputra. As I said, there are other river systems like the Ganges, the Indus River, flowing through India and Pakistan as well. And all these countries depend on these freshwater systems, not only for drinking, as I said, but for agriculture, for cotton, for industry, and for their economic survival. And then ecologically, these waters also affect the ecology of the downstream. For example, the Irrawaddy River flows through Myanmar and Laos and various other countries down south. Now, as the water gathers after the monsoon, it's going to create a great deal of water, trapping small fish in some of the vegetation. And then as the water recedes, the fish is harvested by the local population. So this, again, feeds into the kind of fisheries industries in these countries. And if the water flow is disrupted, either upstream by dam building, or because of climate change, is going to affect the livelihood of billions of people.
Now, Mr. Leung, both South Asian giants accuse each other of hydro-hegemonic behavior, and both have refused to sign a water-sharing or international transboundary water treaty. So the question is, why is this?
Well, this again, geopolitics, rivalry, mistrust, especially between countries like China and India, which have experienced border disputes and also geopolitical rivalry, especially in this time when a lot of the Western countries, especially the United States, which in a way ally with India, is pushing back against China. And then, of course, the questions like Tibet, and the border disputes or border crashes exacerbate this conflict. But however, this river system affecting livelihood of so many people is going to be a major powder keg that's not only affecting India and China, but various other countries downstream. So I think that China and, of course, India and other countries are likely to handle these questions very carefully. And I think the whole thing can only be resolved by further discussions, further negotiations. And there's no point and it won't help matters if this worsen or accelerate a downward spiral into a war.
Last but not least, India and China have been embroiled in a historical territorial dispute, and now the water dispute only risks more escalation. So what could be its possible repercussions for the region and the world?
As I said, I mean, it's going to exacerbate this kind of disputes in a time of global geopolitics involving the rivalry, confrontation between China and the United States. And some of his so-called allies, including India, and of course there is a global rivalry and pushback of the United States against China and perceived as its main near peer challenger for American dominance. So all these are mixed up together, and we are going to have to be facing a very unstable world, I'm afraid, in the coming decades.
Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Shehzad Yunus, an economic analyst, says the already fraught relationship between regional rivals China and India is becoming even more tense over Beijing's plans to build a super hydropower dam in Tibet. A Twitter user, Jari Jamponen, notes that China's dam on the Brahmaputra would be the world's biggest, with capacity of 60 gigawatts, adding that India, too, is considering building a 10-gigawatt dam to counter China's project. Sitan Sibal, a New Delhi-based journalist, cites India's Defense Minister Rajnath Singh commenting on latest border clashes between Indian and Chinese forces. He says the matter has been raised diplomatically.
And that was our episode about the British military's agenda in Afghanistan in the name of development and the India-China tensions over the shared water resources. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Moscow charged Kiev's Western backers with ignoring its warnings that NATO's informal expansion into Ukraine was crossing Russia's red line. Officials in Moscow said Ukraine is being used for a proxy war against Russia by the United States and its allies, and they want to destroy Russia with illegal sanctions. But Russia will confront them and is trying to increase its economic interactions with countries of East Asia and the subcontinent, such as China and India, to deal with the economic sanctions. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Sputnik News Agency has covered the story. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said on Friday, 16th of December, imposing new sanctions on Moscow is a choice of the European Union, but these measures undermine the interests of the member states of the European Union as well. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said, European Union states are abandoning market principles in energy, finance, and in many other areas. This is their choice. But this choice, when implemented in concrete actions, undermines international economic relations in the form in which they have been formed in recent years and undermines the economic interests of these countries. The Russian diplomat said it is impossible not to see that all these sanctions benefit the United States, adding that Russia will develop measures to ensure its economic interests. On Thursday, 15th of December, the European Union agreed in principle on the ninth package of sanctions against Russia. The final technical procedure for the execution of these sanctions package completed on Friday, 16th of December, after which the sanctions must be published in the EU official journal. After that, they will come into force. After Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine last February, the US, the European Union and Britain imposed economic restrictions against Russia. In October of this year, the EU adopted its eighth package of sanctions against Moscow, which included a legislative basis for setting a price cap for maritime shipments of Russian oil to third countries. In December, the European Union also joined the G7 decision to set a price cap on Russian oil at $60 per barrel. The cap will be reviewed every 2 months to remain at 5% below the International Energy Agency benchmark. However, Moscow refused to accept a price limit, saying that Russian oil would only be sold to countries on a market basis. So far, the sanctions have resulted in a major fuel crisis in Europe, record high inflation and skyrocketing energy prices. The English website of Al Sharq Al Awsat newspaper has also covered the same story. Russia says the European Union's latest round of sanctions against Moscow will just exacerbate economic woes within the European bloc. The latest measures, which blacklist nearly 200 more people and bar investment in Russia's mining industry, are part of the ninth wave of sanctions imposed on Russia since President Vladimir Putin ordered the launch of a special operation in Ukraine on 24th of February this year. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova reacted to the measures on Saturday, 17th of December. Zakharova said the current package will have the same effect as all the previous ones, exacerbation of socio-economic problems in the European Union itself. Maria Zakharova also called on the European Union to cancel all restrictions that are having a direct or indirect impact on Russian exports of grains and fertilizers. Russian President Vladimir Putin said recently Kremlin would expand trade cooperation with new partners, including by sharply ramping up gas exports to China. Back in November, the Chinese President Xi Jinping reassured he is willing to build a closer partnership with Russia in the energy sector. Citing an Indian oil ministry source, the Reuters news agency reported recently that New Delhi will continue buying Russian oil and even look for term contracts as sanctions allow purchases, provided that Western services are not used. China and India are currently the largest buyers of Russian crude oil. German newspaper Bild am Sonntag has also covered the same story. The German newspaper Bild am Sonntag reports on Saturday, 17th of December, that dozens of Russians and Belarusians have filed lawsuits at the EU Court of Justice to challenge their inclusion on the sanctions list. The Luxembourg-based court has reportedly received claims that from one company and 61 individuals from Russia and Belarus placed on the EU blacklist over their alleged support for Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. The business figures are seeking to challenge what they view as a violation of their rights and the freeze of their assets by European Union authorities. According to media reports, the plaintiffs in Luxembourg include Russian billionaire and former owner of the English football club Chelsea, Roman Abramovich. ESN Group owner Grigory Berezkin, and Gennady Timchenko, who owns Volga Group, a Russia-based company with interests in the energy sector, transportation and construction. Alpha Group co-founder Mikhail Friedman and Alisha Usmanov, the owner of Russia's largest iron ore producer, are also among those who are suing. The European Union has adopted 9 rounds of anti-Russia sanctions since last February, when Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine. Aside from business people, the penalties include measures against Russian journalists and Russian companies. On Friday, 16th of December, the European Union blacklisted 141 Russian individuals and 49 legal entities, including ministers, governors, judges, parliament members, singers and presenters, as well as 5 political parties. The latest measures also deprive 4 more Russian media outlets of their broadcasting licenses in the European Union, introduced a number of export bans and extended restrictions on 3 more Russian banks. Export restrictions were extended to 168 additional Russian entities closely linked to the Russian military-industrial complex, bringing the total number of sanctioned companies to 410. Meanwhile, European leaders approved an 18 billion euro macro financial assistance package for Ukraine for 2023 to ensure that Kiev can cover state deficits and keep the economy running as it continues to fight Russia. To fund the aid and loan it to Kiev at a highly concessional rate, the European Union will raise common debt, a proposal that initially met resistance from Hungary. But Budapest lifted its veto recently after EU nations agreed to allow the sum of the EU funds it has frozen under the new law mechanism from 7.5 billion euros to 6.3 billion euros. A Polish veto over the introduction of a minimum global corporate tax also threatened the adoption of the assistance package on Thursday, 15th of December. But Warsaw, a staunch supporter of Ukraine, also lifted its objection. Russia launched its special operation in Ukraine last February following Kiev's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreement and Moscow's recognition of the breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin said one of the goals of his special operation was to denazify Ukraine. Since the outbreak of war, the United States and its European allies have imposed an array of sanctions on Russia while supplying the large cache of advanced weaponry to Ukraine, despite warnings from Moscow.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, what are the changes that take place in adolescence that parents or guiders or the trainers should be taking care of?
First and foremost, things which are quite apparent are the changes in the physical nature of the human being. The body form is changing. Things which are which were not there before, in the form of those things which make a woman and a man, and they can carry out a physical union in the form of marriage. Those things were not there before. Even if they were, a child would not know that these are for what. Those physical changes try to make a person realize that he's changing, and he looks at himself or herself and finds herself in a new position. And this surprises a person, makes a person feel happy about it, or confused about it.
Even feel embarrassed.
Embarrassed or start to adore oneself. Look, what I'm changing. I'm becoming an adult. I'm becoming of age. So these things lead to a change in the mind also. There are physical hormonal changes which are taking place along with that. So as the apparent changes are coming in, there are changes coming within which are being caused by those physical changes or are in harmony with those changes. So thoughts and feelings are also being aroused which are different from the thoughts and feelings which were there before.
Yeah.
So now the person has to be able to be taught in such a way that this is something natural. I mean, before...
It's okay.
It's okay. It's something natural. You have to face it. It's not something which you should get confused
or excited about.
Or excited about or embarrassed or whatever. It is something natural, and you have to manage those feelings.
Yeah.
And, of course, unfortunately, in our society, especially in the traditional conservative societies, parents feel embarrassed about talking
to their teens.
That's a difficult situation. So yes, if a parent cannot do it on himself or by himself or herself, then she or he should take the help of a person who can relate to their children, explain to them. Yes, unfortunately, again, in the West, sex education is becoming important. It is becoming that the children should be taught everything. No, not at all.
All right. So you disagree?
I mean, you talk about what the changes are. What do they imply? How do they have to be managed? But you start talking about them, how to have safe sex. Now, mm-hmm. that is something very difficult. I mean, you're telling your children, okay, it's no problem. The changes are there.
So if there are some arousings, you're actually putting catalyst into it.
Exactly. You are providing them opportunities. You are providing them, showing them the path to carry out those things which are not allowed. So basically, children, adolescents have to be educated in such a way. They have to be made. Have to realize what the changes are. They have to understand what the changes are, but they also have to be taught how to manage them. And therefore, it is the duty of the parents. It is the duty of, especially, their school-going children. The schools have to also take care of these things. And of course, according to our understanding, the segregation should take place in the schools.
Yeah,
because it's very difficult to say that you go towards the fire, you sit by the fire, and you don't get burnt. It's not possible.
All right. So we'll discuss more on that important issue after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about the changes that take place in adolescence. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said that in adolescence, they are not just physical change, they are not just hormonal change, they are not just biological change, they are also cognitive changes, they are mental changes, they are different kind of changes, and your adolescent needs not only to be educated about that, but also he should be educated how to manage those changes.
Yes. I mean, the important thing is understanding what those changes are and how to manage them, the feelings, especially the feelings and the thoughts. Because basically, if we have taken care of the intellectual development of the child in the domain of intellectual development, cognitive development, we have to make him understand the difference between pure thoughts, truth, and things which are illusionary, imaginary. I mean, the imagination in an adult becomes very strong. Though it in a child, every child has that imaginative skill in his mind, and it is very important when it comes to constructing ideas, developing new things. Imagination is very plays a very essential role in technology, in many things, in fine arts. But that it has a downside. Imagination, if you allow it to run wild, it will cause you to think of things which will cause those feelings to arise. You will create things in your mind which will seduce you, unfortunately, will cause you to think of things which cannot take place.
And it would be difficult to manage.
Therefore, one has to be able to learn how to control thoughts and then feelings. Thoughts, and the best way to do is to keep ourselves busy in pursuits which are positive, learning things about things which are beneficial for us. The more we are engaged with things which are important in life, the more we can cut off those things which are not beneficial and they are harmful. So we have to, in the intellectual development and the emotional development of a child, and even as adults, we have to be able to manage our thoughts and our feelings. And that is the most important thing. Practices, actions can be managed as a result of the thoughts and feelings that we are managing. Therefore, a child is engaged in activities which keeps him or her involved in positive things, in physical development, mind exercises, management of the, playing games, which create a positive atmosphere, create an atmosphere where his thought process or her thought process becomes advanced, progresses. He is able to think in a pure way, pure thoughts, pure reasoning, mathematics, philosophy, culture.
And much more.
And much more.
Yeah. We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am with Professor Naqavi, and we are discussing about the changes in adolescence. Well, Professor Naqavi, before we discuss more, we have an audience question. This is a lady, Ferdil, from Holland. She says, I have a 17-year-old girl. Her name is Gadir. And I have a 16-year-old girl. Her name is Maryam. The 16-year-old is very, very humble, but the 17-year-old Kadir is so, so rebellious. I don't know how to deal with them. Can you help me?
We have a situation where one of the girls has become rebellious because it means that she, at the age where those feelings had to be managed, because as we mentioned, the changes which are taking place in the feelings, in the emotions of an adolescent, is one of them is that a person becomes aggressive, questions everything, becomes curious, wants answers, wants things to be done the way she or he wants them.
Yeah.
So they, at that age, if a parent becomes aggressive, he or she becomes aggressive in response to the aggression of the child.
Things become worse.
Whereas if he or she, the parents, one of the parents or both of the parents, and it's important that they work together in unison, they work in harmony to control these problems and issues that are being faced. Generally, the problem is mothers are left on their own to deal with their children, especially the girls, because fathers wouldn't like to get themselves involved with girls, especially in those very sensitive issues. But yes, now that the stage of that the teenage has progressed up to 17, she has obviously passed those early
stages, years
of puberty and adolescence. Now she's advanced and progressed into those later years, and she has made an opinion. She's started to develop her own thoughts. She's not just copying them. She's not ready to imitate. She's not ready to accept what the elders are saying. Now you have to become a little bit... you have to engage in an intellectual way. Reasoning should take over the emotional way of trying to control and reacting to the feelings. One has to keep his or her mind very cool-headed approach, being able to understand, trying to become friendly with the child, trying to understand the reason for being aggressive. What is she looking for? There must be something she is feeling that is required. She may be feeling some deficiency. She may even be looking for a husband. I mean, she may be of the age that she requires, she must be married off.
All right.
So the parent has to understand what is she looking for. And that can only be carried out in a very subtle way, in a very tender way, through engaging in discussion, in becoming friendly with her, talking to her in such a way that we are friends. Don't think upon me as your mother. We're friends. We're girls. Let's be happy.
Yeah.
So this is, I think, the way how she could be able to manage that situation.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for helping us with that important stuff. Dear Sister Ferdiel, aggression should not be answered with aggression. As per expert, aggression should be answered with cool-mindedness, and you should help your daughter that her reasoning part dominates her emotional part and engage her in discussions. That's how you could help your daughter, and we will also pray for you. Thank you so much for questioning. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
headlines. Iran's